Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Kerry Lavrov deal to disarm Syria's chemical arsenal by mid-2014 and speak with Joshua Landis, who writes a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics, Syria Comment. We will discuss how the Russian-American deal that Syria has not yet agreed to might be implemented and how the U.S. can maintain a credible threat to strike when the president may not be able to get congressional approval to do so, since the majority of Americans have no stomach for another war. Then we'll go to Beirut and speak with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is writing a book about Egyptian revolutionaries after the fall of Mubarak. We'll look into claims by the Syrian rebels that Assad is transferring his chemical arsenal to Iraq, Iran, and Hezbollah, and question why Americans who love the revolutionaries in Tahrir Square in Egypt seem unenthusiastic about supporting Syrians who oppose their dictatorship. Then we'll examine the humanitarian aspects of the continuing agony in Syria with Rebecca Hamilton, who teaches at Columbia Law School and was a lawyer with the International Criminal Court in Darfur, Sudan. We will discuss the forthcoming UN report on the use of chemical weapons in Syria and whether it will lead to a referral of the Assad regime to the International Criminal Court. Then finally, we'll discuss the new study by economists Emmanuel Saez and Thomas Piketty that finds the rich got richer throughout the recovery from the 2008 Wall Street crash. David Ruscio, a professor of economics at the University of Notre Dame, joins us to discuss the graphic evidence that we are in a new gilded age, as the top 10% took more than half of the country's total income in 2012, the highest level recorded since the government began collecting statistics a century ago. Joining us now is Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and the president of the Syrian Studies Association. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Landis.
Good to be with you.
And the Syrian government has not yet agreed to the Kerry-Lavrov deal that's giving them a week to hand over a list of all of their chemical weapons arsenal. However, Syria's Minister of Reconciliation, Ali Haidar, said, "We welcome the agreement. It is a victory for Syria achieved thanks to our Russian friends." So what's your sense of whether there'll be any kind of hiccup in the very early stages of this long process?
Well, I think there'll be hiccups all the way along. Syria has a lot of reasons not to want to hand over their chemical weapons. And chief among them is that this helps the regime to survive. Not only does it kill people and frighten its enemies, but it frightens the West and the neighbors of Syria, most of whom think that the only thing worse than Assad having chemical weapons is if the rebels capture them. And so that, in a sense, is good for his regime. It means that they don't want the rebels to win, or they're fearful if should the rebels win.
Well, of course, this deal does not stop the Russians from resupplying Syria and the U.S. from supplying the rebels.
No, it does not. And that's going to be, you know, many people are beginning to talk about trying to link this conversation about chemical weapons somehow to further political solution to the civil war down the road. And, you know, the State Department is trying to get up various proposals for Kerry on how one can get to a political solution. So that's the hope, at least, that once you get this dialogue between the United States and Russia on the one hand, and Assad brought along, that perhaps this could lead to more than just restricting the use of chemical weapons and destroying chemical weapons.
So, Joshua Landis, do we have a kind of disconnect here between the broader global arena where Russia and America appears to be working together? President Obama has said that if diplomacy fails, the United States must be prepared to act. There are some questions to whether he has lost his leverage or if he had the leverage since he went to the Congress to strike, because it's doubtful he'll get a vote. And the American people have no stomach for another war.
Of course, he can use unilateral. I mean, he is the president of the United States, and he can send off missiles. And many of the Republicans, in fact, who were lining up to vote against his strike, were telling the news agencies that he should have, he was a coward and he was fickle, and that he should have just gone ahead and used his presidential powers to strike Syria without a vote back in Congress.
Well, I was going to say, though, in the broader arena, there seems to be some positive stuff. On the ground in Syria, nothing's changed. It's just getting worse and worse. But on the outside global stage, the president has confirmed that he's exchanged letters about Syria with Iran's newly elected president, Hassan Rouhani. And he's also said that they actually have Obama said that Iran – the nuclear dispute with Iran is larger than the Syrian crisis, and that what they should do, speaking about the Iranians, just draw from this lesson, is that there is a potential for resolving these issues diplomatically. My view is that you have both a credible threat and a force combined with rigorous diplomatic if you have a credible threat of force combined with a rigorous diplomatic effort, you can strike a deal. So this Obama's already suggesting, as others have before, that the deal that Kerry and Lavrov did is a good blueprint for working with Iran on the bigger issue, as Obama has framed it.
Well, it is. But, of course, as is so well underlined, credible threat has to be generated, or else Assad's going to begin dragging his feet, and this whole thing could easily fall apart.
So what's your sense, then, of whether this is a sellout in terms of the opposition? They're obviously very unhappy with it. The general who speaks for the opposition has already said that Assad is moving his chemical weapons to Iraq, Iran, and Hezbollah. We'll be looking into that in a moment. But would you view this as the U.S. selling out the opposition?
You know, I don't. President Obama was very clear from the beginning that he was only interested in deterring chemical weapons. He was not trying to get involved in the Syrian civil war and change the balance of power. The original wording for the resolution was quite narrow. Now, McCain and others who do want to see the Sunni rebels win and to destroy the Assad regime began to try to expand that in Congress. And Obama did it. Kerry broadened the language of the resolution in order to win the votes of McCain and his followers. It wasn't going to be enough. But that did, in a sense, set the opposition, the Syrian opposition, to hoping that somehow that Obama would get involved deeply. The rest of the world might get involved behind him, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Europe. But the British vote really knocked the wheels out of those aspirations. But there was still great hope that Obama would strike and that this would set off then a cycle of strikes and so forth between Assad and the United States, which could help bring down the regime. And that, you know, because Obama backed away from that, there is great distress amongst the Syrian rebels, no doubt about it. Syrian regime supporters, thrilled. Their children, who are all in the military, it means that they're not going to be struck with American cruise missiles. And so, you know, there was a big sigh of relief from the regime supporters, and the regime opponents are very distressed.
So, but on the other hand, are the Free Syrian Army and the various militias, I think all told about 2,000 of them, are they relieved that they're not going to be struck by chemical weapons?
Well, that is the upside for them, is that as this process goes forward, Assad cannot use chemical weapons, even if he's going to delay, linger, and wait. And that's good for them because it means that chemical weapons, the United States is doing something about chemical weapons. There's a lot of pressure on Assad not to use them. And had nothing been done, it seems quite certain that Assad would go ahead and use these as a part of his tactical arsenal.
Well, obviously what Assad continually says is that the rebels, it's either me or the terrorists, and the extent to which the Saudis and the Qataris have armed and allowed these jihadis in, I think, has played right into Assad's hands. He is obviously going to be around for quite a bit longer, depending upon how this, and it's worth noting that the civil war continues and both the United States and Russia will be arming both sides. The CIA apparently has just recently sent its teams in that is trained. It's taken them a couple of years to get them into the field. I don't know whether that's going to tip the balance. What's your sense of given that this deal, the Lavrov-Kerry deal, goes on till mid-2014, is that an acknowledgement that this war is going to go on?
Yes, it is. And, you know, the United States policy has been to give the opposition, the Syrian opposition, enough weapons so that it does not lose, but not enough so that it can win and destroy the Assad regime. And that's a recipe for stalemate, and it's a recipe for eventual division of Syria along the present battle lines. And Syria could well be divided into three different regions, a Kurdish region in the northeast, an Arab Sunni region around Aleppo and in the north, and then a region controlled by the Assad regime in the south and in the west coast, along where the Alawites are the majority along the ocean. And that's the present reality in Syria. And unless something happens to switch the balance of power, that's going to endure, it would seem, for a long time. It's already been the situation for well over a year and a half, and there hasn't been great movement one way or the other.
And again, I'm speaking with Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and the president of the Syrian Studies Association. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. But my understanding is that the Sunni, and not to mention the Kurds, would not accept a partition of Syria unless they had access to the ocean. And if the Alawites control the coast, how's that deal going to work out?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's a stickler. The only way it would work out is if nobody could win. And, you know, this is why Assad, in a sense, is holding on to Damascus, even though Damascus is a majority, overwhelmingly majority Sunni city. He has tons of rebels and opposition within the poorer suburbs of the city. It's very hard to see how he keeps control of it in the long run. The thing is, he needs to hang on to it. Otherwise, Damascus is the center of money, wealth, the capital. Whoever owns Damascus is going to end up owning Syria. And a little Alawite rump state on the coast would be very weak economically, politically, and every other way. And if he were to retreat back to the coast, it's not at all likely that he would be able to hang on to power there. He would eventually get swept out. And that's the fear, of course, of the regime and of the Alawites, is that they would be pushed into the sea. And that's why they're fighting tooth and nail, and why they're unlikely to collapse anytime soon. But if there's a stalemate that endures, it can be, you know, this would just become the reality. And there's nothing that anybody could do about it. And that is where the U.S. policy and European policy is leading, if it continues to support the rebels just enough so that they don't lose, but not enough so that they can win.
So that's a pretty cynical policy. That appears to be the one we've had all along, right?
It is. Well, and we're also balancing Russia. I mean, Russia is working into this. Iran's working into this. And America has no stomach to really take Syria away from Russia. You know, if you really want to be cynical about it, in a sense, the United States, I think many people in the United States, rue the day that they took Afghanistan away from Russia in 1979, which led to the Taliban, led to 9/11 and Al-Qaeda. And in some ways, I think, you know, as Afghanistan was a poison chalice, many people look at Syria as a poison chalice. What do you do with it if you were to take it away from Russia? It's a country in splinters, and they're frightened of it. They're frightened of what can come next.
Well, Joshua Landis, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Joshua Landis, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and the president of the Syrian Studies Association. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back going to Beirut and talking about the possibility of the chemical arsenal being transferred to Iran, Iraq, and Hezbollah.